So let's start this evening session with a Tonglen meditation. So yesterday we introduced the Tonglen practice and we started with ourselves and someone close to us. So this evening we're going to move out a little bit further. Okay? So let's do that practice. Allowing your awareness to descend into the body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension. Bringing the mind into the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. You can begin by using the Tonglen practice to cultivate loving kindness and compassion for ourselves, and then expand that out to others. So arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if I were free of suffering and its causes. May I be free of all suffering and its causes. The mental afflictions. May I be free of the mental afflictions. Imagine the inner purity of your mind, your Buddha nature, in the form of a small, white, radiant sphere of light in the center of your chest, the level of your heart. And imagine your mental afflictions and suffering in the form of black smoke filling the body. And with each in-breath, draw in that black smoke into the sphere of light at your heart, dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing your mental afflictions and suffering at your heart. And then imagine the black cloud is now completely extinguished. And now you're free of all mental afflictions and suffering. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if I had happiness and its causes. May I be truly well and happy. And then with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out from your heart, filling and saturating your entire body and mind, and transforming into everything you need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending to yourself whatever you need to be happy. And imagine that you've now found the genuine happiness that you seek. And then allow your field of loving kindness and compassion to expand out further. To expand out to the person seated next to you. They are just like yourself in wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. So arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they are free of suffering and its causes. May you be free of all suffering and mental afflictions. And imagine their mental afflictions and suffering in the form of black smoke filling their body. And with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke out of their body and bringing it into the sphere of light at your heart, dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their mental afflictions and suffering at your heart. And then imagine the black cloud is now completely extinguished. And now they're free of all mental afflictions and suffering. And rejoice in this. And arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they had happiness and its causes. May you be truly well and happy. And with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out, filling their body and mind, transforming into everything they need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending to them whatever they need to be happy. Then imagine that they've now found the genuine happiness that they seek. And take delight in this. And then allow your field of loving kindness and compassion to expand out further. And allow your mind to move around. And whoever comes to mind, whether it's a friend, a stranger, or even someone you have difficulty with, attend to them. Breathing in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart. Breathing out the light of loving kindness, sending them whatever they need to be happy. Allow your mind to continue to move around. Whoever comes to mind, breathing in with compassion, breathing out the light of loving kindness. No matter how much darkness is drawn in, it is all extinguished without a trace. And no matter how much light is sent out, it is sent out from an inexhaustible source that is in no way depleted. Breathing in with compassion, breathing out the light of loving kindness. And then release all appearances and allow the mind to come to rest. Resting in awareness itself. Simply being aware of being aware. Resting in luminously clear awareness. I'd like to go on a little bit in the text where we left off in the last session. So we're on page 11 near the top. And we left off in last thing that the Panchalama said was, for that reason I will first explain with guiding instructions the way in which the object of negation appears. Object of negation, of course, is the inherently existent I, or the independent I, and the way in which it is apprehended. So here he's starting to explain how we can investigate this in meditation. He says, within the state of meditative equipoise of shamatha, in the same way as a tiny fish flashes through a still, clear pool of water, use a subtle awareness to intelligently investigate the nature of the person who is meditating. That is, investigate the way in which it appears to the mind, the way in which it is apprehended by the mind, and the way in which it actually exists. So when we investigate and look at the way it appears to the mind, it appears as if it exists independently, inherently. And that's how we apprehend it as well. We grasp onto the me as existing independently. But then if we investigate the way in which it actually exists, it says, when investigating in this way, the way in which all phenomena such as the being, the I, the person actually exist is as a mere name, merely imputed by conception and merely labelled, like labelling snake onto a rope or human onto a can or pile of wood. You know, in the distance, a can, of course, is the pile of rocks. So maybe in the distance and it's not very clear, that may look like a person. You know, if they're sort of out walking in the mountains and over there there's a can marking the pass, they could mistake it for a person. Just as you, when it's dark, you can maybe mistake a rope for a snake. So let's, based on that, let's have a look at what that really means. You know, what does it really mean for something to be merely imputed by conception, merely labelled? So things, when we investigate the way in which me, the person, and everything actually appears, is everything appears to exist independently. And that's the way we apprehend them, because there's no reason to question those appearances, because everything has always appeared to us in this way. So we apprehend them as inherently existent, as independently existent. We grasp onto that. But when we investigate, and we're going to short tomorrow morning, we're going to see the way in which we investigate, and that's how we've been doing it in the meditations this afternoon, we'll come to see or realize that things are not existing in the way they appear. That in fact things exist as being merely labeled, merely imputed. So the reasoning then is that that things are empty of inherent existence, meaning when we come to investigate, we'll come to see that things are not inherently existent as they actually appear to be. Why? Because we'll realize that they are dependent phenomena. And the technical word for that is dependent arising. So this phrase here, empty of inherent existence, this is emptiness. Shunyata in Sanskrit. So emptiness is the fact that things are empty of inherent existence, or they lack inherent existence. They're not inherently existent or not independently existent. So empty, that's what emptiness is saying, that things are not independently existent. So emptiness is not saying nothing really exists. So when we see emptiness, we need to ask, empty of what? What are things empty of? They're not empty of existence. They're empty of independent existence, inherent existence. Why? Because they are dependently existent. Here the word arising means coming into existence. Things come into existence dependently. So what do we mean by the fact that things exist dependently? There are three ways in which things are dependent arisings. The first way is that things exist depending on causes and conditions. For example, this clock here exists depending on causes and conditions. One of the original conditions necessary, of course, someone needed to think about designing the clock. And then all the raw materials needed to be gathered, they needed to be refined, all the various components needed to be manufactured. And then all those components needed to be assembled. And then, of course, all the people and factories and everything involved in the process, also necessary. So all those causes and conditions are necessary for us to have this clock here now. I think that's fairly straightforward. Also, things exist depending on their parts. Again, this clock exists depending on its parts. Without the casing, without the screen, without the buttons, the electronic components, the battery, without all these parts, there would be no clock. So again, the clock exists depending on its parts. Again, fairly straightforward. But remember, this line of reasoning here, that things are dependent arisings, should be overturning the fact that things exist independently. But probably most of us can happily accept that this clock exists depending on causes and conditions and parts, But at the same time, happily accept that when we walk in the door, there's a clock sitting here on the table existing already. True or not? Maybe. But that shouldn't be possible. Because this reasoning should be overturning the fact that there is a clock sitting on the table when we walk in the door, existing already. But it doesn't seem to have that effect, this reasoning. And I think the reason is that we don't really understand these at the deepest level. We only sort of understand them superficially. To really appreciate dependent arising, we need to understand the third way in which things are dependent arising, and that's what's mentioned in the text here. That things exist depending on labelling. Things exist depending on labelling. In other words, used for the same purpose is imputation, designation, conception. So these all mean the same thing. So therefore things are dependent arising because they depend on labelling, imputation, designation, conception. So what does it mean for things to be existing depending on labelling or conception or designation, imputation? We may think, okay, that means there's a thing here which we're calling a clock. Again, that's a little bit superficial understanding. To really appreciate that a little bit more deeply, what we can understand is that when we look out on the world, we're just receiving a mass of sense data. And we have to make sense out of all of this stuff, otherwise we couldn't function. So what do? Is we group collections of data together and we create meaningful objects so we can make some sense or meaning out of all of this. So we're effectively drawing lines around certain collections of data and creating an object. But we not only have to do that, but because we don't live in a world in isolation, in order to communicate with others, we have to give names to the things that we've created so we can communicate. Otherwise, we can't communicate. So imputation, labelling, designation, conception is that process of drawing a line, creating an object, and then giving it a name. How we divide up the world is not fixed. It's completely arbitrary, depending on the meaning that we want to get out of the world. So, for example, how many things are there? How many objects are there? We could draw one line around all of that and say there's one star. We could draw two lines and say there's two triangles. We could draw six lines and say there's six triangles. We could draw seven lines and say there's six triangles and a hexagon. Or we could draw 18 lines and say there's 18 lines there. So is there 1, 2, 6, 7, or 18 objects there? How many things are there? We decide. There's not a star existing there from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework. We create the star by drawing a line and creating that single object. So that's why in the text here it says that things are merely labelled. They're a mere name. They're merely imputed. The word mere means only, just, that things do not have any more existence than existing merely within our conceptual framework. There is no star, existing from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework. And then we, from that, and another terminology we have is that things are not findable, meaning there's no star to be found there in the basis from its own side. So the star is not findable in the basis, because a star, we create that by labeling, imputing conceptual framework. So not only do we see language like things are merely labeled, merely imputed, we also see things are not findable, meaning there's no object to be found from its own side in the basis. And that's why here we see that it says, like labelling snake onto a rope and labelling human onto a can or pile of wood. The snake on a rope is the classic analogy that's used to understand that things are merely labelled, they're not findable. So just like there's no star to be found, like we have a piece of rope on the ground and it's dark. So because we can't see clearly, we mistakenly assume that there's a snake there. That's the analogy. Now we are obscured by our ignorance, and we mistakenly think there's a star to be found there, when in fact, star is something merely labeled, merely imputed. So this is a classic analogy to show that the object cannot be found amongst the basis. There is no snake to be found in the rope. Just as when we search here, there's no star to be found here in the basis. Now, let's now go back and look at these two points again, briefly, based on this idea. So this is a timeline, this is a seed, and this is the plant that it produces. So we say that the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. The underlying cause, of course, is the seed. The conditions are the soil, sunlight, water. So that combination, we produce the plant. We now instinctively believe that things exist independent of us. There's an independent seed that produces independent plant. So the question is, at what point in this process does the seed become the plant? Where does the seed become the plant? Remember, we believe things exist independently of us, meaning they exist independently of our conceptual framework. Therefore, it should be a fixed, obvious point where the seed becomes the plant. So where is that point where the seed becomes the plant? Exactly. We decide. When this configuration of data stops looking like our concept of seed and starts looking like our concept of plant, then there's a plant. And our concepts of seeds and plants are slightly different. So for some of us, already that's a plant. Some of us will be here, some here, some here. We decide when the plant comes into existence. The plant exists depending on cause and condition. So the result exists depending on the cause. But this view of emptiness is also saying the cause depends on the result. How does the cause depend on the result? Exactly. You couldn't call something a seed unless you have the idea plant. Whether or not it produces it, irrelevant. You can't call something a cause unless you have the idea result. Let's look at parts now. This pen exists depending on its parts. But is there a pen to be found here from its own side amongst the bases? Can you find a pen there? Is this a pen? No. Is this a pen? No. Is this tube? Is that a pen? No. Is this tube, just the tube, is that a pen? No. Is the ink inside a pen? No. Is the round ball on the end a pen? No. Is the other piece of metal a pen? No. Where's the pen? Figure out. Oh, that's easy. It's the collection of that stuff. There's a collection. Oh, no. Has to be in a certain shape. Okay. You have to tell me when the pen comes into existence. So, again, what we can understand from this is the pen only comes into existence when this configuration of data closely enough resembles our concept of pen. And our concepts generally have at least two parts, appearance and functionality. So when this appears closely enough to our concept of pen and it seems to function according to our concept of pen, then there's a pen. Not before. We bring the pen into existence. There's no pen to be found here amongst the bases. So what we're saying is that the pen exists depending on its parts. The pen is not the collection of the parts, because there's no pen to be found amongst the collection. So if we can understand those two statements are saying, not saying the same thing, we're beginning to understand something about emptiness. So the two statements are, the pen is the collection of the parts, versus the pen is merely labelled depending on the collection of parts. Any questions? What? The pen is the... The pen is the collection of the parts. That's what we normally say. We say, this is a pen. And the other statement is, the pen is merely labelled depending on the collection of the parts. I mean, that's what it says here. It says, when investigated in this way, the way in which all phenomena, such as the being, the eye, the person, actually exist, is as a mere name, merely imputed by conception and merely labelled. That's what this sentence means. The problem is, of course, is that we don't realize we are doing this. We don't realize that we are drawing lines, creating objects, and giving names. Because it appears as if the world is already divided up into many separate, discrete things. What's the problem with seeing the world divided up into many separate, discrete things? We looked at that in the last session. The suffering in its causes chart. If we believe the world is already divided up into many separate, discrete things, then when we see a particular object and we have a pleasant experience, we're going to naturally assume there's some attractive quality in that object. see it as inherently attractive. I like to be happy. That seems to be causing my pleasure. I want that thing, attachment. So that's the problem with seeing things as already divided up into separate things. We develop attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things, and the whole mess starts there. So what we're doing is we are turning the lines that we draw, we're turning them into hard boundaries. We're seeing the world as made up of boundaries, lots of separate, discrete things. Question?
No, I was just wanted to comment. I find it interesting that the word conception in English language, it kind of implies this, because it's also a birth.
Oh, conception, yeah, it's a birth, yes. Yeah, so moment of conception.
Conception we
yeah, birth. Something's born. Yeah. Very good, yes. Now, in most of our experiences, the very first line we draw is we draw a line around here and we create the experiencer because there's single experience. Within single experience, there are two aspects, the experiencer and the experienced. And we need to draw the line and create the experiencer. Otherwise, we couldn't even distinguish ourselves from anything else. So we have to do that. So there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with drawing lines and giving names. The problem is we don't realize we're doing that. So again, we draw the line and we give the label, me, I, experiencer, agent, whatever the label is. But the problem is then we contract around that me part of the experience. And we believe there's an independent me here to begin with. And that's self-grasping. We grasp onto the me part of the experience and believe that it exists independently of the experienced. But that is completely irrational. To highlight that, really, we can ask a question. Is this big? Is it big? So we can't say it's big or small. On its own, it just makes no sense, does it? You can't have big and small. No sense. Big and small can only exist relative, dependent. Likewise, you can only have up with down, in with out. Like that, you can only have me with not me. Experiencer with experienced. Subject with object. But when we grasp onto the me part of the experience and see there's an independent me and an independent world, that belief in independent me is like saying this is big. Just makes no sense whatsoever. But that's what we believe in. So what we're doing is we're splitting ourselves off from reality. We are seeing ourselves as independent of the world of experience. Means we're completely out of sync with reality because the reality is interdependent. Experience, the experiencer, interdependent. But when we see ourselves as independent of the experienced, we're out of sync with reality. And when we're out of sync with reality, we're fighting against reality. That's why we have mental afflictions, we suffer, and the people around us suffer. And often in our behavior, this self-grasping is quite strong. There's often this perspective of me going there, me doing that, me saying this. It's always me with this self-grasping. So it's often very strong. The stronger the self-grasping, the more out of sync we are. Sometimes in our behavior, though, this self-grasping is not as strong. And that often happens when we are more focused on the activity rather than the agent, the me. And this often happens when we have quite good focus, when we're absorbed in watching a good program on TV, we're absorbed in reading a good book, we're absorbed in solving a problem at work. In those occasions, we're more focused on the activity than the me. So the self-grasping is a little bit reduced. And we know from our own experience in those occasions, things seem to go quite well, time seems to go quite quickly. Why? Because we're not fighting against reality as much. We're a little bit more in harmony with reality. And that's even amplified even more by people who've developed a high level of focus in their activity. People like professional musicians, professional athletes, who spent thousands of hours of training in their activity. So much so that they've developed a very high level of focus. And then often when they're in their activity, they often report they're in the zone or the flow state. So much so that sometimes they say, well, there was just the music playing. There was no sense of me. There was just the sporting activity happening. What's happening, and of course, not only do they report that, but they report peak performance, optimum performance. Why? Because self-grasping is very much reduced because of the focus on the activity. Of course, this is only due, self-grasping is only a little bit dormant due to the power of concentration. So here in the Vipassana practice, of course, we're talking about eliminating the self-grasping, not just subduing it a bit due to concentration. Eliminating it by realizing there's no independent me, no independent world. So that's what we're doing in this section of the text here. Any questions?
Well, the concept itself is a little bit kind of...
The concept of
detrimental result of self-grasping. I mean, on the other hand, self-grasping is kind of a simplified way to react to the world around from the part of individual.
Well, from a Buddhist perspective, it's unnecessary and it's harmful.
Well, again, that's a question. I want to raise a question.
Sure.
I think for any entity, would it be some machine or would it be an animal or whatever, there is no other way to exist in this world except that putting the boundaries on the things around and creating the concept. Otherwise, no any entity that is an independent entity, it cannot exist as such.
There's a difference between, you used two different words there. You said creating conception or something?
Labeling.
Yeah. So, yes, if we don't do that, we can't function. If we don't label and create entities, we can't function. I think a newborn baby can't even do that. It can't distinguish itself from the world. It has to learn that. So you're right. If we don't label, if we have no conceptual framework, we cannot function. We cannot exist. But the problem is, that's necessary. But then on top of that, we grasp onto the conceptual entities that we've created and believe that they're not conceptual entities, that they exist independently. That's the problem. That's what we're trying to overcome.
I agree about the emotional problem.
No, not emotional.
About the functional problem, each entity wants to kind of, it has to be self-sufficient, and it, at some sense it's egoistic, it has to be selfish if it wants to remain an entity separate from the whole.
No. Historically, it's only through cooperation and communication that the species have survived, that humans have survived. It's through believing that we're independent entities that all the problems begin. So we don't have to wrongly, you know, creating through a conceptual framework means it is an entity. There is an entity of me, a clock, and so forth. That's an entity. But that does not imply that that entity exists independent of any conceptual framework. So to believe that it exists independent of the conceptual framework is the problem. That's where mental afflictions and suffering comes in. So if we can eliminate that false view and just stay within the conceptual framework, then we can function optimally with no mental afflictions and suffering. But if we don't create a healthy conceptual framework, then we're dysfunctional. So there are, of course, some mental illnesses where people can't create healthy conceptual frameworks. So if you can't even do that to begin with, that's also dysfunctional, of course.
They create some weird conceptual framework.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They hallucinate, fabricate something that's not meaningful or functional. So, yes, we have to create a meaningful and functional framework, conceptual. If we don't do that, we can't function. But if on top of that, we then see that framework not as a conceptual framework, but as existing independent entities, then we have all these problems of mental afflictions and suffering.
I just had the idea that is it a biblical rebellion from paradise? In Bible, there is rebellion from paradise, Eva and Adam. Is it the same when people started to feel them independent from their surroundings?
From a Buddhist perspective, it wasn't like everyone was okay and then something went wrong somewhere. Because you can't create, ignorance can't start from nothing. So you can only have that false view from false view. So from a Buddhist perspective, there was no first beginning. And that's actually a little bit similar to in physics. You know, they talk about the origins of the universe. But one of the fundamental principles of classical physics is conservation of mass energy. You can't create it, you can't destroy it. So when it comes to the origins of the universe, one of the most common theories, of course, is Big Bang, but they wouldn't say that the Big Bang means the universe popped into existence from nothing. They usually say it's some infinitesimally dense something that exploded. So they wouldn't even say at the physical level that material stuff comes from nothing. There's always a cause. Similarly, in the mental world, things don't just pop into existence. They have to have a cause. So you can't have a pure mind then suddenly becoming impure.
This is explained beautifully in Kabbalah. Kabbalah is the same thing. So because
sure.
of that, I asked you.
Sure.
I have read probably six books about Kabbalah. And now it's open. And now it's open. And even the main creation from Kabbalah, 17 books altogether, is now translated and you can buy it.
Good.
And but it is also, they explain the creative of universe, that it was big emptiness, and then came idea to create, and then it was the density, which is named Big Bang.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the one theory in classical physics now with that origin is a cyclic Big Bang, and that's a little bit similar to the Buddhist theory of the cosmos as well. So there's some parallel there. Good,
yeah.
Good. Enjoy.
If I have a right view and I know that apple is just something labeled.
Yeah. Merely labeled, yeah.
Merely labeled.
Then you would enjoy.
I know that its good taste and its sweetness is not its somehow inherently existent and.
Yes.
To this apple.
Yes.
Not,
sure. It doesn't exist. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Those qualities
sure.
do not exist in that object, let's say. You know?
Yes.
And if I have a right view.
Yeah.
So what that happens? I can't.
What happens?
I can't enjoy apples anymore, or I don't want it anymore.
What would happen is you would enjoy the apple much more than you do now. Because now, particularly if we really like apples and we have some craving for apples, that craving agitates the mind. And then if we really like it, often we eat it quickly because we want it and we eat too much and then we feel ill. And so we're worried that we're not going to get enough of it. So when we're eating it, we're not actually even really enjoying it as much as we could. So if we get rid of that craving and we happen to like apples, we would enjoy the apple much more. We wouldn't get frustrated if we couldn't get the apple. And if we could, we wouldn't eat too much, and we would enjoy it much more than we do now. Sure.
And somebody gives me beer instead
sure.
of apple.
Sure.
Like, I know that taste is okay.
You don't like it.
Me who creates
sure.
that.
Sure, sure, sure.
But in any case, without that basis for that labeling, there is no that quality.
I was waiting for you to say that. So now... This is going to come up tomorrow morning. This is the difficult point with this view, is, and it goes back to what we talked about before, the two extremes, existence and non-existence. For us now, for things to exist, to function, they must be real. They must exist from their own side. There must be some taste there from its own side. There must be some attractiveness from its own side. If it's not, it doesn't really exist.
But
wait.
I can't make beer taste like apple.
No.
I just want it.
No, but what I'm saying is that now we feel somehow emptiness negates functioning world, negates enjoyment of things, but it doesn't. You know, often I hear people say, it doesn't matter because everything's empty. I mean, that's completely the wrong idea. That's false view. Because things are empty, everything matters. Means that because think of emptiness, then there is nice tasting apples and there is not so nice tasting pears. And we can enjoy the apple without craving, and we can eat the pear or avoid the pear without aversion. It is. Exactly. That's what the point is now here. Things are empty because of dependent arising. That is exactly the point. Emptiness and dependent arising are two sides of a coin. And so one way of poetically saying that is emptiness is fullness, fullness is emptiness. Functioning world is emptiness, emptiness is functioning world. Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly the point. Because craving is believing that is existing independently of our conceptual framework. That's what craving is believing, that the beauty is there. But don't we say beauty is in the eye of the beholder? Don't we say that? Isn't that true? If beauty is in the eye of the beholder, what's to crave out there? We're creating the beauty. The beauty's not there to grab. We're creating the beauty. We're creating the great taste. And we can enjoy the beauty and the great taste without the craving.
But if there is no object, like there is nothing from what we could create, that taste of beauty or something. Yes, that's the question of basis. Like,
yeah, so you're going...
On what to impute taste and...
Okay. Any last question? Otherwise, I think I'll stop there for the evening. Okay, let's leave it there. And so again, we'll finish off with the Shavasana, of the corpse posture meditation. Again, in the corpse posture, the feet slightly apart, the hands a little bit away from the body, the palms facing upwards. as an act of loving kindness for yourself. Allow your awareness to descend into the body, right down to the ground, becoming aware of sensations where your body is touching the cushion or the floor. And then allow your awareness to rise up and fill the entire space of the body, becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. Mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. All the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. Allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply becoming aware of the rhythm of the breath. Noticing if it's rough or smooth, long or short, deep or subtle, without trying to alter or control the breath in any way. And maintain an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the rhythm of the breath. So in conclusion, we'll make a dedication. So again, I'll begin by reading Shantideva dedication prayer. And then following that, if you want to make your own personal dedication as well, then there's time for that after the prayer. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world.